The Shekhinah is everywhere in the world, right? But it's but that's what it says. It's in the west as you go west. So Shekhinah b'mayrib, that's what it says. The Shekhinah is in the west, and that's why the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west, because all day long the Shekhinah is, the sun is bowing to Hashem. That's what it says in the Midrash and the Gemara, that the sun is bowing to Hashem, and therefore it sets in the west. When you take with any place that you look at with, that the, what the, to make it holy, the holiest part of that place is in the western part of that place. So, for example, the Beis HaMikdash, right? The holiest place in the world is Yerushalayim, Jerusalem.
Oh, the western wall, right? The western wall. That's why they call it the western wall.
But what's special about the western wall, besides the fact that it's on the west? But there is a southern wall, and there is a northern wall, and there is a eastern wall. There's still, all those walls are really still standing, right? So what's so special about the western wall? Why do we specifically daven? It's a little hard to daven, as I said, at the eastern wall, because there's a cliff, a valley that goes down. But if you wanted to have a nice place to daven, you go to the southern wall, and it's very wide open. Although there are steps there, but it is very wide open. And the northern wall, which is the Arab quarter, basically, it's just the Arab quarter because that's the way Israel, but everything used to be the Arab quarter. Why did the western wall become so special? The place always Jews went to, and then later they cleared it out a little bit. It's still not the whole thing. Is because the Beis HaMikdash was behind the wall. The walls are the walls around the Temple Mountain, but the Beis HaMikdash itself, the temple itself, was inside those walls. And the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, was pretty much right up against the Western Wall. So most of it was an open plaza, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, is up against the Western Wall. So the reason we daven today at the Western Wall and at that spot is because it is the closest that we can come from outside the Temple Mount to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark, the Aron was with the Luchos, the tablets, and so on. So that's the West. So I'm just telling you that the West is a place in any given area. If there is an opportunity to set up part of that area as holier, you take the Western part. Now, in our shuls, being that Israel is to our East, so our Aron Kodesh is placed on the Eastern Wall. But that is not so in the countries that are to the West of Israel. In the west of Israel, Aron Kodesh is placed on the western wall. So, in other words, the reason we have east so special in our shuls is simply because of our location in the world relative to Israel. But in any one single location, like for example, the United States, so what is the holiest part? If you're making this argument, I don't know if that's 100% holds up, but I'm just saying, if you're making an argument about any one geographic landmass, the most holy part of that geographic landmass is its western part. Again, not relative to another place, but relative to itself. So anyway, this week's Torah portion, which is Parshas Vayigash. Parshas Vayigash is the storyline is that Yehuda approaches Yosef, who is the viceroy of Egypt. And he tells him, listen, Yosef, I have a big complaint against you. He speaks very politely, however, and he says, why are you starting up with us? Why are you not allowing Binyamin to go back to our father in Israel? Eventually, the brothers do reconcile, and Yosef does show his brothers that he, in fact, he proves to them that he's Yosef. He is their long-lost brother, and the family does come down to Egypt, and they do stay in Egypt from that point forward for 210 years. Of which the first 17 years, Yaakov is living in Egypt. And Yaakov, the Torah later tells us in the beginning of next week's Parsha Vayichi, that in fact, Yaakov's best years of his life were those 17 years that he lived in Egypt when he was together with his whole family and he saw all of his kids keeping the faith and keeping the traditions and not worshiping any of the local gods and so on. Haftorah, which is in these parshas, is relative. The Haftorah, which is in these parshas, the Haftorah is thematic with the parsha, similar theme that the way the Haftorah was chosen, talks about a prophecy by the Navi Yechezkel, the prophet Ezekiel, the prophet Yechezkel. Prophet Yechezkel lived during the time, mostly during the time of the exile between the first and second Beis HaMikdash, first and second temples. He started his prophecy 6 years before destruction of the first temple, and there were 70 years in between, and that is when most of his prophecies were given. As a matter of fact, most of his prophecies, in fact, were given not in Israel, but in Babylonia, in Babel, what is today called Iraq, and part of Iran. And there is a prophecy that he says, and that is this week's Haftorah. And he says like this, Hashem came to me in a prophecy and he said, take two sticks, two pieces of wood, two branches. On one of them, write the word Yehuda. On the other one, write the word Yosef. And Ephraim, who is Yosef's son, Yosef's, one of Yosef's two children. And put the two sticks together, and you will see that they will become united in your hand. They will become together. The two sticks that were previously two pieces of wood will become one piece of wood. And when the Jews say to you, what are you doing? What does this mean? What is the symbolism here? You should tell them that there is a division amongst the Jewish people that is symbolized by Yehuda on the one side and by Yosef on the other side, because the Jewish nation was in fact divided between the two kingdoms, the kingdom of the north, which was ruled by somebody initially who was from Yosef's descendants, and eventually they became terrible idol worshipers, and they were destroyed by the Assyrian king and taken into exile. These are the 10 tribes that were lost in exile. And then there was the kingdom of the south, that was the kingdom that was led by Yehuda's children, meaning the children that came from David HaMelech, from King David. And the Jews were divided. And when Mashiach comes, the prophecy of Yechezkel says, the division between the Jews is going to be erased, it will disappear. The Jewish nation will become together again as one. And then the Haftorah actually concludes with the following sentence. The Haftorah says, my servant, King David, will be the king over the entire united nation of Israel, the entire united Jewish people forever. And then he says, my dwelling place will be among them, among the Jews. I will be a God to them. They will be a people to me. Then all of the nations of the world will know that I am Hashem who sanctifies Israel, and my sanctuary, the Beis HaMikdash, will be among them forever. So this is, it ends on a lot of beautiful note that the Jews are going to live forever in Israel, and there's going to be a covenant. I will seal a covenant of peace with the Jewish nation, with the Jewish people, an eternal covenant. I will place my sanctuary among them forever. So that's the Haftorah. So the story, therefore, of the Parsha and the Haftorah is the reconciliation between the two opposing forces of Yehuda on the one side and Yosef on the other. The split between the Jewish nation that exists because of Sinas Chinam, first of all, baseless hatred, but that also exists because there is a difference in the way different parts of the Jewish nation serve Hashem. So there is actually not just a bad reason for the difference, but there's also a good reason for the difference between Jewish nation having different streams and different ways. I'm talking all as long as they're all keeping with the Torah, but different minagim, different customs, different ways of doing things, as long as they're all led by the Torah, by the Shulchan Aruch, by the code of Jewish law, and as long as they're all led by one unifying leader, is important to have different ways to express our connection with Hashem. Just like there's a difference between people in general. Some people are more excited about music, about art, about literature, about whatever it is. You don't have to always be the same as everybody else. As long as your goals, as long as your focus, as long as the purpose for your existence is all the same, as long as we're united in our attempt, what we're trying to achieve, the methodology of achieving that does not have to be the same. Having said that, and that's in fact what we read about during Hanukkah, We read the Haftorah during Hanukkah. We talked about another vision of another prophet, and that was the vision of the menorah that has seven branches that are being fed by streams of unending, continuous flow of olive oil feeding the menorah. And the concept of the menorah having seven branches as opposed to one lamp. Why should the menorah have seven lights? It should have just one light. When you walk into a shul and you have a ner tamid, a constant fire that's burning, a flame or light bulb that's burning in front of the base in the Aron Kodesh, the Ark, which incidentally most Chabad shuls do not have. It's not the Chabad custom for whatever reason, but it is the custom in most shuls around the world to symbolize the eternal flame, both of the menorah and of the altar of the Mizbeach that never went out, that fire of the Mizbeach. So why should the menorah have seven? Why shouldn't it just have one branch? What's wrong with one? And if it's seven, it should have 17. Why seven? And the answer, of course, is, according to Kabbalah, we can understand very clearly that there are seven different methodologies of approaching Hashem, all as long as they're according to the Shulchan Aruch, of course, you're doing the mitzvahs, but the emotion that with which you're approaching Hashem, that's different depending on the type of person, your personality. So there are, in fact, different ways to approach Hashem. And they are symbolized, generally speaking, by the two ways of Yehuda's approach and Yosef's approach. So let's spend a couple of minutes, and this is what I'm building up to, what, in fact, is the difference between Yehuda's approach to serving Hashem and Yosef's approach to serving Hashem. And what does it mean, a reconciliation between these two? Because if there are two different ways to approach your responsibilities, your obligations to doing mitzvahs, then why do you have to be, so to speak, reconciled? Why does it have to be one leader? What's the point? So the Zohar explains to us, and the Midrash also says this, and the Zohar is part of the Midrash, in fact, that there is an individual who's going to be called Mashiach ben Yosef, an individual called Mashiach ben David. There are two processes, two steps in the redemption of the Jewish people. And that corresponds to two reasons for going into galus, going into exile, having the tsaras, having the troubles of our current times. So we turn back to last week's parsha. And Yaakov Avinu, none other than our great, great, great patriarch, Yaakov Avinu, says to the brothers, he says in the language of the Chumash, he says, Lama Hari Osem Li, why did you do this terrible thing to me? To tell the ruler of Egypt, he didn't know it was Yosef at the time that they were speaking to, that you have another brother, and this other brother, Binyamin, and now I have to send him down, and now potentially I'm going to lose him. Says, Lama Hari Osem, why do you do this bad thing to me? Now, the question is it really bad? So when we look at the world that we're in, and we're in a very imperfect world, to put it mildly, we're in a very, very imperfect world, a lot of troubles. The times that the Jewish nation, for the last 3,300 years plus since we left Egypt, you want to include the 200 years of Egypt is 3,400 plus 30, close to 30, well, the 210 years in Egypt, 116 years of slavery. We left 3,334 years ago because it was the year 2448. Now is the year, well, we're already five because it's two, now it's 257, 83 minus 2448. So that's 35 years ago, plus the 116 years of slavery. So we're talking about close to 3,500 years, round numbers, that we have had as existence from Yaakov, almost 3,500 years. How many of those 3,500 years were we living in a perfect idyllic state? Very, very, very few. A few years, pretty much during the time of Shlomo HaMelech, for a few years. Very, very imperfect. David HaMelech at the end of his life. King David, King Solomon. Otherwise, we have had it. Even during the times of the Beis HaMikdash stood in various forms for 1,200 years. So even during those times, the Jews were battling their enemies and there was idol worship going on, even though the temple was standing. we're living in a very imperfect world. So what is this all building up to? The answer is it's building up to Mashiach. It's building up to the time when David HaMelech, King David, will return together with all of the tzaddikim who will come back to life, will once again lead us, whether it's David HaMelech's neshama or himself, again leading us, or his neshama in the body of another great tzaddik, which is, of course, what we believe that neshama of the great tzaddikim keeps on transmigrating and so on into new generation. So it's all the same neshama, really, from David to Moshe to on, Yaakov on down. So this is the time that we're waiting for. And there's two methodologies to accomplish this. And they are symbolized in broad strokes by Yehuda on the one side and by Yosef on the other side. What is the difference? Yosef was the viceroy of Egypt. He was appointed by Paro. He was subject to Paro. As a matter of fact, in the Chumash it says, Paro says to Yosef, I'm giving you full authority over Egypt, but I am telling you that there's one thing you can't do, and that is you can't overrule me, Paro. Up to the chair, up to the throne is your abilities, but not the throne. I am the king, and I'm going to tell you what to do. Yosef took that authority that Paro gave him, and in fact, he remade the entire Egypt according to the way he wanted. So, for example, even in the literal story, Rashi tells us that he told all the Egyptian males to circumcise themselves. They have to have a bris. One of the beautiful commentaries explain that the reason he told them to have a bris, different reasons, either because he didn't want that his fellow brothers and of course not sisters have need the bris, but the mothers have to circumcise their kids, their male children, that they should eventually forget about the mitzvah of bris. So he knew that the way the Jewish nation is going to roll is the way they're going to copy, unfortunately, the way that the Gentiles are. And therefore, he made it so that everybody had a bris, and therefore the Jews will also have a bris, or that they shouldn't be ashamed and embarrassed to have circumcision, if all the non-Jews have circumcision. Anyway, turned out that it didn't help forever because the Jews, in fact, left the mitzvah of circumcision until Moshe came and returned it to them. Another beautiful comment is that, just a parenthetic comment, that since Yosef acquired all of the Egyptians as slaves, because they gave up their land and their money and they sold themselves into slavery for food during the years of famine, Torah law is that when a Jew owns a slave, that slave has to circumcise himself. And therefore, Yosef had actually an obligation to circumcise himself. The point anyway is that Yosef had an effect on Egypt and controlled the Egyptians to till such an intimate detail that he made them have a bris, a circumcision. For sure, he controlled their money. I mean, we know that Stalin and Mao Zedong and every other dictator in the world controls the people's money. I mean, for sure, in those days, the Pharaoh of Egypt and Yosef, who was second, controlled the money of the people. So this was like no big deal, no brainer for a dictator to do that, a king to do that. So Yosef had total control over Egypt, and he elevated Egypt to the best of his ability, but it was all subject to Paro. That means he could go a certain distance, and that's it. So yes, it's true that Yosef was living in the metropolis. He was living in the capital city, and it's true that Yosef himself was not affected. And it's true that by the metropolis, by the corrupt moral state of Egypt. And his children, in fact, were also not affected. And Yaakov, when he saw Yosef's children, it remarks on that. He says, how do you raise such amazing kids? And he explained that it's not just him, it's his wife. That's actually what Yosef said. Yosef said, it's just my wife, who is the daughter of Dina, is the one who, Asnat, the daughter of Dina, she, it's her credit. So this is a beautiful additional commentary on this week's Parsha. And Yaakov was, of course, duly impressed with Menashe and Ephraim. He loved them dearly. He elevated them to the status of their uncles. He made them tribes for their own because of this, their greatness. But Yosef still could not change Egypt more than Paro allowed him. So again, Yosef himself was Yosef HaTzadik. He was himself completely perfect. He was himself completely above the Egyptians. But to change Egypt more than Paro allows, Yosef could not do that. Yehuda, by contrast, Yehuda was able to change Egypt. Yehuda was able to make Egypt no more Egypt. And therefore, we find that when Yaakov was about to go down to Egypt, and he says, I'm not going to Egypt. Egypt's a corrupt and moral place. There's only one way that I'm going to bring my family down to Egypt with my little kinderlach and my einiklach and so on, my grandchildren and my children. And that is if Yehuda goes in front of me and opens up a yeshiva. If Yehuda goes and opens a yeshiva, then I will go down to Egypt. And in fact, the Torah tells us, as Yehuda, shalach lahorot lahorot goshna, he sent Yehuda down to Egypt to open up, Rashi tells us, a base Talmud, a Talmud Torah, a yeshiva, a full-blown yeshiva. And once he had a yeshiva in Egypt, then Yaakov was able to go down himself. The obvious question is, if Yehuda is one of the sons, and you have to appoint somebody to open up a yeshiva, make sure that the zoning laws are followed and the government doesn't allow you and whatever else you need to open up a school, purchase the land in the right place and all kinds of stuff, wouldn't you think that Yaakov would simply ask one word from Yosef, who owns the whole land? Why doesn't Yosef open the yeshiva? Why does Yaakov need Yehuda to open the yeshiva? And as I mentioned to you, Rashi tells us, the literal, and Rashi is a literal interpretation, literal meaning of the Chumash, that Yehuda was the one who was chosen, not Yosef, who was already, so to speak, the owner of the whole Egypt. And the answer is, again, the same answer, because Yosef was subject to Paro. And Yaakov says like this, I don't want a yeshiva where the people studying in that yeshiva are religious and from Jews, but they have a glass ceiling. What's the glass ceiling? The glass ceiling is subject to the laws of the ruling authority who is not a Torah person, subject to the laws of the ruling authority who is actually self-idolizing, actually morally corrupt. I want that my yeshiva should be subject to only one law, that's Hashem's law. And only Yehuda could accomplish that. So this is the difference between Yehuda on the one side. Yehuda was able to rise up above the limitations of Paro. Yehuda was able, and that Yehuda becomes us. And Yehuda becomes David HaMelech, King David. And I mentioned to you that there are two Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef, according to Arizal, dies before Mashiach comes. Mashiach ben David is the one who brings the Geula, the one who brings the redemption. So this is difference between working within the parameters of the natural order, within the parameters of what we have at our disposal, versus, and it's almost a versus, it's almost completely different because it's a completely different type of thing we're talking about, working above nature, working direct connection to Hashem's limitless connection, feeling limited, feeling underneath the thumb. Yes, you're a religious Jew, you're keeping it, but you're within the confines of whatever some greater force is telling you to do. Versus, no, you're directly connected. You're actually changing. You're setting the terms. We as Jews, we are supposed to set the terms for the world. We're not supposed to be subject to the limitations that the world would seem to place upon human beings, ordinary, and definitely not the limitations a human being would place on us. So this is the theme, therefore, of the Haftorah, when these two methodologies of serving Hashem reconcile. These two methodologies, serving Hashem within the confines of nature versus serving Hashem in a supernatural way. This is a superman who I'm not subject to any of the limitations. I'm not, my yeshivas, my teaching and my belief, my faith, my emunah in Hashem is not subject to any kind of ceiling, glass ceiling or not glass ceiling, you know. It's limitless. My connection to Hashem is not limited by anything that's trying to hold me back. This again is the story of Hanukkah. The story of Hanukkah is, not to digress too much, the story of Hanukkah again was that the Syrian Greeks told the Jews, we don't mind if you're Jewish. We don't mind if you have your own country. We don't want you to be supernatural about what you're doing. We want you to be traditionalist, quote unquote, but don't say that you have this super connection with God and all these mumbo jumbo things that nobody could see with their eyes. You want to have gefilte fish? Go right ahead. You want to have matzo balls? Go right ahead. You want to have knedlach? Go right ahead. But don't say that you have a neshama. Don't say you have a special connection with Hashem. We're humans. You're humans. Stop with the nonsense about the spirituality that nobody can see. And the Maccabees said, no, this is not so. And that's why they had contaminated the oil in the Beis HaMikdash. They said, you guys believe you have the special oil that nobody can touch. You know what? We're going to put our finger inside every single flask of oil, and we're going to stop this mishigas that you have with your special oil, and you can't use regular olive oil like everybody else, normal person, uses regular olive oil. And in fact, the miracle was that after that whole battle, not only did they won the battle, they still found one jug that the Yevanim, the ancient Syrian Greeks, were not able to contaminate, that in spite of the best efforts to lose the special and uniqueness of being Jewish, the Yevanim, the ancient Syrian Greeks, were not successful. And they weren't successful, not only because Hashem didn't let them, but because the Jews themselves stood up against them, even though most Jews at that time, unfortunately, were Hellenized. They believed in this entire line of reasoning. They said, you're right, Syrian Greeks, you're right, we're not so special. We're humans, you're humans, let's sing Kumbaya, we're all together, we're all the same. But that's not what Hanukkah is about. Hanukkah is not about singing Kumbaya with everybody else. Hanukkah is about Yehuda. Hanukkah is about getting the message of Hashem to the rest of the world that we should all serve Hashem, not Caesar, not Paro, not Antiochus, not the logic, the laws of logic, not the laws of reason, but what is above logic, above reason, our neshamas, our connection. And that is the story, therefore, of the reconciliation, meaning that ultimately, when all Jews come together, and all Jews come together under David HaMelech. Who is David HaMelech? The composer of Tehillim. David HaMelech is the one who teaches us spirituality. All of the deep, deep spiritual concepts that the Zohar talks about is mostly based and explained in Tehillim, in the book of Tehillim. And that's the gift that David HaMelech gave us. Most of the concepts are straight out of Tehillim. And his, not only with his leadership, but also his teaching. And also his methodology, and that of course started with the methodology and the leadership of Yehuda, David HaMelech's great ancestor. David is a direct descendant of Yehuda, obviously, a member of the tribe of Yehuda. And that's Mashiach, has to be a member from Yehuda, and specifically from David HaMelech, from King David. So therefore, this week's Torah portion, just to wrap up, is the story of the Jewish power to be able to rise up even above the power of sticking to our Judaism in spite of oppression. But this is greater than that. To change the oppressor into a follower, that's yet greater. So if you want to sum it up in a few sentences, that's exactly what it is. Yosef is the one who keeps Judaism alive during the times of oppression. Yehuda is the one who takes the oppressor and makes him a believer, takes the negativity, turns it around. So when Yaakov said, Lama Hariyosa, why did you do such a bad thing to me? Hashem says to Yaakov, I didn't do a bad thing to you at all. Why are we suffering in exile for so many thousands of years? Hashem says to us, you think you're suffering. You don't know what you're accomplishing. You don't know how great is the mitzvahs that you're doing. You don't know how great is the spiritual energy that you are bringing to the world. You will one day, hopefully very soon, hopefully today, see and realize what exactly you're accomplishing. But let me tell you, Hashem tells us in this week's Haftorah, you're not suffering to the extent that you think you're suffering. Yeah, you're working hard. Yeah, you're working hard. Yeah, it's very difficult. But there is, in the language of the Nevi'im, yesh sachar lepul asech, there is a reward for everything that we're doing, and we're doing incredibly, incredibly great and huge things, which unfortunately we cannot see and appreciate with our eyes today, being in Golos, being in exile. But when Mashiach comes, and again, hopefully today, we will be able to understand, to recognize what exactly we're accomplishing, in the same way that when the Jewish nation finally left Egypt, after 210 years in Egypt, of which the 116 were terrible, terrible Holocaust suffering conditions, They did empty Egypt out of all of the spiritual sparks, which was the reason they went to Egypt to begin with. That's from the Zohar. And
Yehuda and David, there is a parallel between the two of them. I don't know if any significance just occurred to me. David actually taught us the power of Teshuvah, that he was doing Teshuvah so much that in the evening he was doing Teshuvah for the things that he did, because he was so elevated already by his Teshuvah, what he was doing, that he had to do the Teshuvah for that. And Yehuda also taught us the power of Teshuvah, right? Because first he admitted that he was wrong, and then he again admitted this Tamar, and again said that, you know, she's higher than me. So, and that's how Messiah is going to come. Messiah is going to come from there, from, I guess, this. The power of Teshuvah, maybe that's what we need to learn.
100%. The Zohar has the very fascinating statement that Mashiach is going to come to teach tzaddikim, and one of the things Mashiach will accomplish will teach tzaddikim how to become a Baal Teshuvah, how to make tzaddikim even more perfect, in other words. In other words, perfection itself is still not perfect, because you could always be closer to Hashem, which is what Teshuvah means. Teshuvah means to come back. Lashuv, to come back. So coming back means...
To be reborn as a different, on a higher level. To be reborn on a higher level.
To come closer to your source. Teshuvah means to come back closer to your source. How close can we come to Hashem? The answer is that's an infinite process. We're never going to be God, right? So we could always come a little closer.
So in the end, Joseph never did Teshuvah. Like, he kind of like was the little bit of opposite. He was arrogant in the beginning, or he seemed arrogant to his brothers. That's what caused this entire thing to happen. He was kind of like more like Adam. He, you know, said, "Oh, it was not my fault. It's to blame the woman. It was someone else." So like he kind of like, well, he had a prophecy and he had it, and he said, "Okay." So
that's an interesting question. So Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik. That means Yosef never did a sin. You understand? He was tested. What was his test? His test was with Potiphar's wife. He didn't give in, at least according to one opinion. He gave in not at all. He was called Yosef HaTzadik. Having said that, if you're looking for negative aspects of Yosef, so yes, the fact is that Yosef stayed away from it initially, according to the literal story, is he spoke Lashon Hara about his brothers, okay? Having said that, his Lashon Hara was not Lashon Hara. It was intended to elevate his brothers. So that's a question. That's an interesting question. Is it really Lashon Hara if you go over to somebody and you're trying to elevate them? So, you know, presumably he initially told the brothers directly what it is. And then I guess in his mind, at least, it didn't work. So then he told Yaakov, and then the brothers were upset. Why are you getting Yaakov, the father, involved? What is that a sin? Is that Lashon Hara really? Probably isn't Lashon Hara, you know. It depends how you'd say it. So did Yosef do a sin? And then the question becomes, he stayed away from his father for 22 years. Was that a sin, you know, not honoring his father? And then there's another story where Yosef loses 10 years from his life. He's supposed to live 120, he lives 110. And Rashi tells us that's because he allowed the brothers to debase their father in front of him. What does it mean? They called Yaakov your servant 10 times, so he lost it. So are all of these negative? So there's another way to look at it, not negative. So Yosef, at the end of the day, Yosef was the king. You know, Yosef, yes, he was subject to Paro, but he's still called Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef is considered to be perfect. So whether or not Yosef, can Yosef become more perfect? That only Yehuda can make Yosef more perfect. Because exactly as you point out, Yehuda is the one who shows the way for true teshuvah. So a Baal teshuvah can make a tzaddik more perfect. That's the advantage of
the Baal. Well, here is the problem, Rabbi. If you're already so perfect, then how do you improve yourself? How do you go up to the next level? Isn't it the problem of angels?
Has two parts. We have a nefesh abahamis, animal soul. We have nefesh alkiyas, godly soul. So the nefesh abahamis can mess up. Nefesh alkiyas never messes up. The godly soul doesn't mess up. So the question becomes, how do you the path for making your animal soul more in line with what your mission is supposed to be, that's easy to figure out. Because the animal soul is the one who strays in the first place. How do you make your nefesh alkiyas greater? And get more energy for your godly soul. That is that's the Mashiach can do that. And that, as we know, is what the Al-Rebbe talks about in Tanya, where you have different levels of your neshama are able to be influencing and felt by the person. And there is a glass ceiling there where Hashem does not program to begin with people in a certain way. In other words, you can't become a tzaddik just because you want to be a tzaddik, assuming you're acting perfectly. That Hashem has to unlock. So Mashiach will unlock that, and ultimately we call that the level of Yechida, right? The Yechida level. So this is, listen, and spiritually we are supposed to be striving for higher, higher, bigger, bigger, bigger. To get there, Hashem has to unlock certain doors for us, and that's Mashiach's going to do. Yehuda's going to do for Yosef. So one person's one mitzvah to uplift everybody else. One mitzvah one person does raises the entire. If we're all in a boat together, this is from the Zohar, by the way. This analogy of being in a rowboat together, and if you make a hole under your seat, you drown everybody together. On the other hand, if the water is raised, so everybody goes up together. If the tide goes up, everybody's in the same boat, so everybody goes up. This is from the Zohar, this analogy. So this is, we're all, as you say, you're absolutely right. So